Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Hello, Willis.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, we were not at the Shasta District Fair all week, so that was really a huge improvement in scheduling. We just went back to work. It's so great. Oh, my goodness. A lot of nice people, though. It was really fun. So, it's time to do another national security update because there's a lot of stuff going on and there is a tremendous amount of misinformation. Not even sure if we could quantify all of it. I just called today's show the world stage. I thought I'd give Claire a wide open field. So it's June 28th, 2025, and our guest today is Claire Lopez. I will give you the short bio, and I have posted the long one. We'll probably get into some of that. But she received her BA in Communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and an MA in International Relations from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. She completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before declining a military commission to join the CIA. And then she did a bunch of stuff that she probably doesn't get to talk about anymore, but she learned a lot of things, and it makes her her insights super helpful and super valuable with all the things that that we're being told. Some of which I'm sure is true, some of which I'm sure is fiction, depending on who you listen to. But we just did a show with her May 25th, and that was really helpful. But I think probably the most useful show we've done with her, and we probably should hit the topic again, was in October of 2024. So if you still think that there is a two-state solution available and that Palestine is an actual country with a history and all that, I really, really hope you pop onto the page for today again, June. Oh, it's 29th, not 28th. That was yesterday when I did the page. God, it's hell to be a crazy person.
You're a time traveler.
Yeah, I was a time traveler. I was too. But the myth of Palestine and the two-state solution is what we called that program. We've aired it several times since, but honestly, it's something that is not promoted well, not taught for obvious reasons, and we have a lot of people who are completely in the dark about how that all works, hence the level of protest we see. So, Claire, now that it's not the 28th, it's the 29th, where would you like to begin?
Well, first of all, to thank you guys for having me back again. Glad to be with you on the show. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's an awful lot to talk about.
We appreciate you allowing us to force you to be our hostage for 2 hours. I realize your time's valuable, but I swear every time you come on, like, an hour, we're like, oh, it's over.
Just got started.
We just got going. So, you know, from your vantage point, just out of curiosity, like when you watch the reports of what's going on now, is there something that kind of lights your hair on fire? I guess to put a
well, specifically with regard to what?
You know, as you're watching the reports of what's going on now.
Well, I mean, in the United States, in Mexico, in Central America, in South America, in China.
Hey, come on. I already said it was the world stage. You could pick anywhere you want.
I think the main topic lately has been the Middle East and what's happening over there and a lot of misinformation coming from, well,
everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Well, it is important to choose, you know, where to listen, where to read. For myself, I try to get a broad spectrum of media and inputs, think tanks also. And some of the best, you know, are the usual. Fox News is good. Also, Newsmax is very good. I myself, I'm often at One America News on their weekly briefing panel with John Hines. And then some of the think tanks that are really good include Jack Keane's, retired general, Jack Keane's Institute for the Study of War, very good, and also Hudson Institute is very good on a range of topics. Then as far as the media itself goes, I would add Breitbart to that list. A few more that'll come to mind, but those are the top ones that I try to consult, get inputs from all of them in my inbox every single day. Just the News, that's the one I mustn't forget. John Solomon's Just the News is also another very good one.
I like him.
Yeah, very much so.
He was always a really solid researcher.
Pardon?
He was always a really solid researcher when he came on
the scene.
Absolutely,
yes, yeah. Very reliable, very careful, you know, about doing their homework before they put something out.
Claire, one of the things that I don't know, I'm a little bit confused about is you hear people say, well, if the Iranian people, you know, could kick the mullahs out, that country would fall in line and we'd be okay. But these are the same folks that kicked out the Shah and gave us the mullahs that we have to deal with and have dealt with the last 40 years. Do you think if something happened to the Ayatollah, we would just end up with more of the same?
No, not at all. It's been 46 years since 1979, and the huge younger cohort of the population in Iran is two full generations removed from there. The people that form the majority of the population in Iran today have no idea what life under the Shah was even like. It's literally more than two generations removed. So the people there now very much would like to change this regime. And it's not just one Ayatollah. I mean, there's like tens of thousands of Ayatollahs in Iran. But, you know, what we're really looking at is a regime, a hierarchy that is made up of the Shiite clergy, the top ranks of the clerics in Iran, the judiciary, and then the military that props them up, the IRGC, the Pasdaran, the Quds Force, the Basij. All of these, by the way, of the military individuals and their headquarters, their facilities, were struck by the Israelis in Operation Rising Lion that preceded our own U.S. involvement about a week ago, which was called Operation Midnight Hammer. But all of those military organizations were hit. Many of their top leadership were eliminated, as well as quite a number of the Iranian top-level nuclear scientists. I've heard numbers anywhere from 15, 16, 18 people removed. That was the brain trust of Iran's nuclear weapons program. We're not even talking about their biological and chemical weapons programs, both of which they have, just like Saddam had them as well, yes, advanced, sophisticated. But put those aside, because the main concern right now has been the nuclear weapons program and the ballistic missiles that would deliver those warheads, which, yes, they were developing warheads. I think that's what prompted Israel to have to go to make that decision to move. There were places where the Iranian regime and, you know, some of those top scientists no longer with us were working on the final steps to adapt their warheads. Again, yes, they have warheads, adapting them to fit, to be placed, to be fixed onto the nose cones of their missiles. I'll add something to that, too, as it occurs to me here. You know, not only are the younger population in Iran, I mean, you know, about 35 and under, They are the ones in the streets. They are the ones, you know, multiple times since 2009 when we abandoned them before, in the streets protesting this regime, chanting or writing in graffiti on the walls, Mark Bar Khamenei, Mark Bar Dictator, which means death to Khamenei, the supreme leader, death to the dictator, him. But also there is a complete falling away from Islam itself. Shiite Islam is the state in a religion in Iran, but the young people are falling away in such numbers that they are having to close tens of thousands of mosques because nobody goes anymore. So it's a very different population, different people, different you know, experiences over the last 46 years than those who led the revolution against the Shah back in 1978-79.
So you think those folks that led the revolution, you think their numbers now are smaller than the general population, and that population
oh, yes,
will have
certainly
a chance to stand up and face, because the military is really what's putting all that down. I mean, they're the ones with the guns, and
that's right, yes.
I don't know that they would have the horsepower to really make that change, would they?
Well, here's another perspective on it. The Iranian population today is somewhere around 90 million people. But geographically, around the perimeter of Iran, are approximately 50%, maybe a little less, 48-49% of the Iranian population that are not Persian. They are Baluchis to the east, southeast. They are Azeris in the north. They are Kurds up against the Iraqi border to the north and sort of northwest. The Ahwaz Arabs to the east and the southeast. Some of these have been in armed rebellion against Tehran for years, especially the Baluchis, especially the Kurds, and especially the Ahwaz Arabs. They are armed. They are in rebellion already, and they're nearly or about close to 50% of the population. The other 50% is made up primarily of Persians, some other more minority groups that I haven't named too. But interestingly, the supreme leader himself is an Azeri. And those around him, some of those top-level people are also Azeri. But I'll tell you what is making a comeback, or at least maybe I should even say has never really gone away, and that is the people's remembrance of their own heritage. There's a reason why the language in Iran today remains Farsi. It is not Arabic, as in all the other Islamic conquests of, let's say, North Africa, elsewhere in the Middle East, and so forth. They all speak Arabic today, but not in Iran, because of the commitment, I mean, the absolute commitment to preserving the Farsi language, especially on the part of some of their greatest poets, like Hafiz, Ferdowsi, you know, the writers who gave us the Shahnameh, the history of the kings, right? They preserved the Farsi language. Yes, there are many Arabic cognates in it now, and flat-out Arabic words, yes, but they speak Farsi. They don't speak Arabic.
Hmm. Yeah, this is all the stuff that gets left out and why we don't really understand what's going on over there, because it all just looks like a big mystery and a lot of fighting.
Yeah, well, I think most people, if you talk to them, they would say that the majority of the population over there is Muslim.
Nominally so, but who does the polling, and how many are willing to say, no, I reject religion and I am just non-religious right now, or I'm atheist, or I have converted to Christianity? Who's going to tell a pollster that?
Yeah, right.
Right.
Somebody with a death wish.
No, that's not going to happen. But the truth is, from you know, accounts from people who have family and friends over there. There's not much left of allegiance to Shiite, especially 12er Islam, you know, the following of the 12th Imam, except among the top leadership. You know, as we said, clerical, judiciary, military, who are rigorously vetted for ideological purity and allegiance to the 12er eschatology. Aside from them, maybe their family members. That's about it.
I didn't know that. So it sounds like if they can get organized, that they may have a shot at turning that thing around and rejoining the world stage.
It'll happen. It'll happen. Now, exactly how or exactly when, not sure, we can say. But if we recall back in the days when the Shah was coming down, again, 78, 79, what really happened? What came together? A nationwide strike. Everything and every industry went on strike. Right now, we've had a trucker's strike in Iran for the last 3-4 weeks. Across the country, there are 31 provinces, and in every one of them, truckers went on strike. I think remain on strike. But now, if they would include the rest of the transportation industry nationwide, that would make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
The bazaars in Tehran closed down at least a week ago. Maybe it was even two. If the bazaars across the country shut down, that would make a big difference. If, you know, the oil industry, oil and natural gas industry workers shut down, went on strike, that would make a difference. And I'm not even talking about armed resistance at this point. I'm talking about how the Shah came down. Yes, there was fighting, you know, in the end, certainly. But what happened there in 78 and 79, again, also, is that elements of the Shah's own military, you know, there's the Artesh, which is the conscript regular army service, and then there are those elements I mentioned, the IRGC, the Quds Force, the Basij, and they're different. They're not the same. And in the 78-79 lead-up to the fall of the Shah, elements of his military, the Artesh, refused to fire upon their fellow citizens in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
They refused to shoot and kill, you know, their own people. If that were to happen, that even a number of units of the Artesh were to revolt, and go into rebellion against the regime, refuse to shoot or attack their own fellow citizens, that would make a difference. Have to wait and see.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Claire Lopez. And we're looking at the world today, all the bits and pieces, primarily Middle East, and how that's going to affect everybody else. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Six gun in my hand, behind a gun, I make my final stand. It's why they call me.
Okay. Had a little sound challenge there. You know, it's not a Sunday without a little challenge. That's just how the world works.
Claire, the last time they had there, when they you know, ran the Shah out, that was the students were kind of up front on that. Is that where's the whole student mentality on the clerics now? Are they in revolt as well? I mean, are they going to support any kind of a revolution, do you think?
Well, it certainly has been the young people out front in the streets in all of the many uprisings from 2009. We'll recall the Green Movement, and Obama, of course, abandoned them all in the streets to be slaughtered. But very notable, I would say, was in September of 2022, another nationwide uprising. And we'll recall then that the young Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini was her name, traveling with her family inside of a car in Tehran. And apparently her hijab slipped a little bit and some piece of hair was showing through the window. Horror!
Oh, the horror. Yeah.
And the car was stopped. She was dragged out of the car. She was dragged to police headquarters and bludgeoned to death.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
That was the start of the Zan Zendegi Azadi, women, life, freedom protest movement that lasted even really to this day, but was led in particular by young women, but the young men joined them too. So yes, in terms of the university levels of young people in Iran, they're at the front, of the protests that have gone on really throughout the 46 years, but especially more recently now.
And they're not followers of the Shiite movement, is that right?
Oh no, they're done with religion. I mean, it's not even that they're converting to something else, although some have converted to Christianity, yes. But in the main, they're just dumping religion. Period. They've had it up to there with it, and they don't want religion at all. And interesting, of course, some of the most organized and, leading Iranian opposition groups like the Mujahideen Khalq inside of Iran, the top biggest member of the NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran, the umbrella group for Iranian resistance, located with its headquarters literally two blocks down the street from the White House in Washington, D.C., But the 10-point plan is what I want to point out here. The 10-point plan of the NCRI leader, Mariam Rajavi, a survivor of the Khomeini regime, who fled eventually with their top people, now headquarters outside of Paris. She, in 2006, put out what she called the 10-point plan, and it is the statement of their plan, their program for an Iran after this regime. And among those 10 points are things like complete separation of religion and state, non-nuclear Iran, no more support for any Islamic terror groups, gender equality, protection and even autonomy for some of these ethnic groups that I mentioned earlier. These are things that any of us here in the West, in the United States, would support: a free market, capitalist economy. All of these are among the 10 points of their plan for how to change government in Iran. They're seeking a democratic republic. How to change that regime from what it is now, a brutally repressive Islamic terror regime, to one that is, again, a non-nuclear democratic republic.
Well, all of the, when you look back on all the pictures and things of Iran in the 70s and prior, it was really modern. I mean, it looked just like here. Everything was very modern.
They were moving in that direction, yeah.
And then suddenly, everybody's wearing a tablecloth, and women become, all the same. They could be anybody under the thing, and no options. Everything locked down. And just out of curiosity, that transition from, I mean, you know, women wearing shorts and bathing suits and all these
miniskirts on the campuses.
Right. I mean, it was just really
with the guys.
Yeah, just looked like here. How
normal?
How fast was that switchover?
It was pretty quick and pretty brutal. What happened is that after the revolution itself, and Khomeini, we'll recall, had been in exile first in Iraq for many years, and then the final, I don't know, year and a half or something spent in a place outside of Paris in France. But in February of 1979, in collaboration, listen to this, in collaboration with the Muslim Brotherhood, the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, financed by a guy named Yusuf Nada, who is the founder of something called the Al-Taqwa Bank that financed both the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda back in years past, paid for not only that final exile at a place called Château-le-Neuf in outside of Paris, but also the flight back to Iran, February 1979, that plane landed. Supposedly there were going to be, this was what was promised, there were going to be elections, parliamentary elections. And so the various parties began to campaign and speak, and the leader, Masoud Rajavi, of the Mujahideen Khalq, which had actually helped to overthrow the Shah, who believed that the new regime under Khomeini would actually keep its promises about open, free, and fair elections. They believed that. And so he's campaigning, filling entire stadiums with people coming to listen to his campaign speeches. And very soon after that, from no more than 80-81, the Khomeini regime had established the IRGC, armed them, and they literally took to the streets and simply gunned down everybody, not just the Mujahideen Khalq, but communist groups like Today and the Fedayeen and others who had joined together to overthrow the Shah, absolutely just mowed them down in the streets, gunned them down by the tens of thousands.
Wow.
And that's when groups fled Iran and went next door to Saddam Hussein at the time, Iraq, found safe haven there, from which to carry on now in opposition to the Khomeini regime. But that's how quick it happened. And that quick, the women, I mean, this is Islamic law. This isn't something that parachuted in from Mars. This is Islamic law, 1,400 years old or almost, is embraced completely and totally by this regime. They are Shiite, which is, of course, the minority, about maybe 15% of worldwide Muslims, with the majority being Sunni, maybe around 85% or so. But this is straight out of the Quran, the Hadiths, the Sirah, the Sharia. There's nothing weird or odd or made up. This is faithful, devout adherence to Islam. And under Islamic law, women are to be subjugated. They are to be covered. They are to be subordinate to men who, in verse 434 of the Quran, are supposed to beat them if they merely fear disobedience from women. That's the Quran. They're not disobeying anything. They're not extreme. They're not radical. This is straight up the middle Shiite. Yes, Shiite, but Islam. The differences between Shiites and Sunnis have to do with not the doctrine, not the ideology itself, but rather things like the role of the clergy in leadership of the country, of the religion and the politics. Things like the keeping of shrines and grave sites, which Shiites do and Sunnis do not. Those are the differences. But as far as doctrine and ideology, absolutely mainstream, straight up the middle, nothing extreme, nothing radical about it. This is mainstream doctrine.
So how does such a small percentage of the population, you said 15%, how do they, or how are they able to seize control and maintain control of the rest of the population.
Oh, well, I meant in the world, Shiites are about 15% of all Muslims, and in the world, Sunnis are about maybe 85% of all Muslims. But in the country of Iran, it was first overrun by the Islamic armies back in about 642, 43 or so, and that was the Sunni Islamic armies surging out of what would become called the Arabian Peninsula. They were conquered. The Persian Empire went down to defeat. The Safavid Empire went down to defeat after having exhausted themselves in years before in battle with the Byzantine Empire, which went down shortly thereafter. So they were all Sunni. Well, they were not willingly Sunni, but they were forcibly conquered by Sunnis. But later on, in about the, 12th century or so, Turkic Shiite tribes from the north poured down and conquered Persia, as it was called then. And at that point, they forcibly converted everybody to Shiite Islam. These people never get a choice. It's not like some democratic election.
Right.
They're forcibly, you will convert to Shiite Islam or that's the end of you. Well, that happened maybe around the 12th century, but certainly by the 1500s, Persia was solidly Shiite. Solidly Shiite. And it remained so really until, I would say, the 20th century. And certainly now it is nominally still Shiite, but not in practice.
So what's the percentage of Shiites in Iran now? I mean, they hold power. Are they still a majority?
Nominally, we go back to who's taken the surveys, right?
Yeah.
So nominally, the country is still categorized as Shiite, majority Shiite. Obviously, they're not majority Shiite practicing or adherent. They're not. They're just not. But I don't think we know the numbers. That would be a very difficult thing to get accurately.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, because who wants to pipe up and say that they're,
They're not.
They're not.
Christian or something.
Yeah.
Oh, because why? Because under Islamic law, to apostatize from Islam, be it Shiite or Sunni, is a capital crime. It is a death penalty crime to apostatize from Islam. So to openly do that in a country that's still under the tyranny of Islam, that's taking your life in your hands. You're going to get a death penalty.
And is there any type of judicial process, or do they just off? We saw you out there.
Yeah, it lasts about 5 or 10 minutes, and then they're taken out and shot.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, religion at the point of a sword. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, this is straight out of the Quran. Muhammad said, actually, I think it was Khomeini, people cannot be made obedient except by the sword.
Yeah, well, that's fairly
clear.
That's
how they think. I mean, if you call it thinking, but this is how they...
That's like how it works. So when people say, "Well, why don't they?" It's like, well, the consequences are slightly more severe than here. When we come back, I'd be curious. I don't know why or how you think that this has been sold in the United States, especially like on our campuses and all that stuff. That all this is some magical trip over there, and I've always fascinated the gay rights people and all that. I mean, if they went there, they get killed faster than the Christians, right?
They have no idea.
Yeah, not a clue. So let's hit that when we come back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Me and all my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing, and there's no way we ever could. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. We just feel like
figure if Miriam Rajavi needs a theme song, we could give her that one. How do you think, I don't know, can anyone explain really what's going on in the streets of our cities these days?
Well, we're looking at a red-green alliance. It's not just the streets, it's the campuses, too. And in both those instances, we'll see collaboration and coordination among and between the forces of Marxism and communism and the Islamic movement in the United States that would be led by the Muslim Brotherhood and its front groups. They seek chaos. Overall, the two of them, both, the red and the green, seek chaos in order to foment a revolution out of which each of them think that they'll emerge on top.
How do they square all this? I mean, if they ever went there,
have no idea. We have seen some of these, you know, Mike on the campus or Mike on the street interviews people mm-hmm. have done.
Yeah,
hilarious, right? They'll put the mic up to somebody on the streets of New York or maybe the campus of Columbia University or someplace, and they'll say, something like from the river to the sea. Which river is that? Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's the Amazon. They have no idea.
No.
Well, which sea is that? River to the sea. So which sea? I don't know. Maybe it's the Bering Sea. They have no idea what they're talking about. They just know that it's cool and it's chic to put on one of those tablecloths, either the black checked ones or the red checkered ones, a face diaper on, and they run out and they're part of the cool kids club.
Yeah, and in reality, there is no tolerance for any of the things these guys are protesting for.
No, again, I was mentioning before how apostasy from Islam is a capital crime, death penalty crime. Well, there is a set of crimes, about seven of them altogether, called the hudud crimes and punishments that go with them. And the reason these are selected out is because these are mentioned in the Quran itself. And they include apostasy. They also include homosexuality. Not doing anything necessarily, just being homosexual. A few other things like highway robbery is in that group too, and a few more other crimes. But you get the idea. These are death penalty crimes in places where Islamic law is enforced. Now, there are lots of places, maybe, where people will claim to be Muslim, but Sharia is not actually enforced. But in Iran, it is.
Yeah.
And Gaza. We're talking about, if they want to go over there, Gaza. That is a place where the Gazan branch of the Muslim Brotherhood is called Hamas. That's an acronym, Harakat Islamiyah fi al-Iraq, Harakat Islamiyah Mukawamat Islamiyah, which means the Islamic Resistance Movement, and they enforce Islamic law. That's who they are. And if, some of these young idiots were to go over there, with their rainbow flags, they and the flags would soon be tossed off the top of a tall building.
Yeah, because, right about the time you get off the plane.
Not tolerated. It's simply not tolerated over there. And in many places, Iran is one of those places. Afghanistan is another. Pakistan is another. Somalia is another. The places where Islamic law is actually truly enforced. Now, many places in the Middle East, are nominally Islamic, like Saudi Arabia, for example, but many of the laws of Sharia are simply not enforced anymore.
Wow. Well, I constantly, And I suppose there's really no way to get through to any of these folks because none of this is ever brought up.
Well, not on the campuses, it's not. Because why? Because our campuses have been the target of both communist Marxist and Islamic infiltration for decades. The students who graduated, you know, way back, some of them at least, turned around and became professors themselves, moved on up through the ranks, became administrators, college trustees and presidents and so forth. And this is how it works, that ideology, those ideologies are perpetrated from generation to generation. And why so many Ivy League schools like Columbia, Yale, Harvard, and so forth, California, University of California campuses, Berkeley, and so forth, why they're so rotten, absolutely rotten to the core, anti-American, anti-Western civilization, the kids who go there and graduate from there haven't a bloody clue what is true and real in the world. They have no idea about America, you know, our foundational principles, foundational documents, not a clue. All they know is they've been pumped full of indoctrination for 4 years for an underwater basket weaving degree, and off they go trying to get a job and get their student debt forgiven.
Yeah, that's just insane. One of the reports I heard last week was following the airstrikes. Iran's on a big tear now where they're going out and executing yes. people they think were spies. Do you think that's yes. going to backfire on them?
Well, I mean, certainly it will within the country, but the point here is that we know that the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad, had been operating inside of Iran probably for decades, at least years and years, and had established an extensive network of assets inside of Iran on the ground who not only helped them to learn what was going on inside of Iran's nuclear weapons program and ballistic missile programs, but also physically to locate and pinpoint the targets that, you know, the Israeli Operation Rising Lion eventually struck. How did they get, you know, the information to hit so precisely, you know, certain leadership of the IRGC? The IRGC Major General Commander, Hossein Salami.
Yeah.
The commander of the IRGC Aerospace, Hajizadeh. And all of those scientists that they eliminated. How did they get that information to send missiles literally straight through the bedroom windows while the entire rest of the apartment building was untouched? Okay, that kind of information comes from an internal network mm-hmm. on the ground. And I heard reported a week or more ago, 10 days ago, that the regime, through regime media outlets, Tasnim was one of those, that the regime was offering about the equivalent in U.S. money of about $1,000 for information that would name, identify Iranians who had worked with the Mossad. We also know, of course, the Mossad set up a FOB, F-O-B, a forward operating base in Iran. Remember this? Outside of Tehran, where they smuggled in the parts for drones and missiles, put them together, assemble them inside of that FOB, or FOBs, I don't know, maybe there were more than one, that were outside of Tehran, and there to counter any expected retaliation of firing of Iranian missiles once the Israeli attack had begun. And very effectively, right there on Iranian soil, they were knocking down any of these missiles they were trying, or drones, that the Iranians were trying to shoot off. They never got out of their silos, or they never got out of Iranian airspace. So that all was possible, was made possible by the incredible, courageous, on-the-ground resistance forces who are Iranian, and yes, some of whom are now being rounded up, and others, simply because they're Jewish, are being rounded up, jailed, probably worse, in retaliation, because the internal security forces of Iran are still functioning, at least to some extent. And yes, they are rounding people up, you know, killing a whole lot of them, jailing, probably, like I said, worse, torturing, killing them, just on suspicion of being Jewish or of suspicion of being assets of the Mossad.
Hmm. Do you think the Ayatollah survives this in the long run?
Do you mean the Supreme Leader?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's not really even an Ayatollah, you know.
What is an Ayatollah, anyway?
Well, no.
Like, what makes you an Ayatollah?
It's the clerical hierarchy, and you have to come up through a system of scholarship in places like the theological seminaries of Qom, the theological seminary city about middle or so of Iran. And you advance from one level, and there are specific levels from one to another, depending on your success in scholarship of Islamic jurisprudence and the law, you know. And so at the time, in 1989, when the Ayatollah Khomeini, the revolution leader, died in 1989, the designated successor was a grand Ayatollah. That's the tippy top, a Marzai Taqlid, grand Ayatollah, top of the clerical ranks. The Ayatollah Montazeri was the designated successor, but he had spoken out and criticized the prison massacre of 1988 at the end of the Iran-Iraq War, when then Khomeini, still alive at that point, knew that with the cessation of the war against Iraq and Saddam Hussein, the focus would then switch back domestically, and his domestic opponents, including the Mujahideen Khalq, would be the leaders of opposition to the regime now. And so Khomeini had something like 30,000 of them massacred inside the prisons, and the Grand Ayatollah Montazeri criticized that. So he was knocked out of the succession, and they had to find somebody else quick, because Khomeini had died in 1989. And so what did they do? They alit on this Khomeini, Ali Khomeini, who was only at that time at the rank, it's a middling rank, called Hujjatul Islam. Very middling. He did not have much scholarship. He didn't have students who followed him. He was not a Marzai Taqlid, which means somebody that they emulate and follow. He was just a middling rank, a journeyman, if you will, in clerical terms, Hujjatul Islam. But what they did then to make him the supreme leader, because they had to hurry, right? They bumped him up artificially to be called an Ayatollah, but he didn't have the credentials to be it, and never has had the credentials to be an Ayatollah. So he's not really, but he is the supreme leader.
But I guess if he can kill you, survive, I guess you call him Ayatollah if he says so, right?
No, we call him many things, dictator for one, and supreme leader for another. But he's 86 years old, not in the best of health, and you know, he is widely reviled and hated by many of the Iranian people. One way or another, he's not going to be around too much longer.
You think they'll toss him, or do you think that the revolution will change all that?
There are different possibilities. If the IRGC leadership, now, of course, minus their top commander, as I said, Hossein Salami, is gone, but, you know, whatever's left of the IRGC, decide that he's no longer an effective supreme leader, they could stage a coup and bump him out of there. At which point, you know, a military IRGC regime could take over. That would be a very bad thing.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And we don't know if that could happen or not, but it's a possibility. Otherwise, if the people, as we were talking about earlier, take to the streets in mass protests, mass strikes across the country, and also elements, units of the Artesh, that's the army, the conscript army again, revolt, that could tip it over. We don't know yet. We don't know right now what's going to happen. But I'll tell you what, calling a ceasefire in the middle of winning the war really just took all the pressure off of the Iranian regime and freed them not only to restart their nuclear weapons program the best they can do with whatever's left of it, but also to crack down now, as we're seeing, on the Iranian people, abandoned once more.
Okay.
Abandoned. Just totally abandoned.
Hold that thought. We have to give 5 minutes for the news, and who knows, maybe the world will be totally different. We'll be right back with our guest, Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People. Find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. Let's see, today is June 29th. Can you believe it? June 29th, 2025 already. And my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
So, let's hurry back. Hurry back to our guest today, Claire Lopez. And very timely, right before the news, everything she was talking about was actually in the news break, which was kind of funny. But we learned a lot more from Claire than we did from the news break. So I really would encourage you to check back on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Click back later this afternoon or any time after that, and you'll find the archive posted. It's commercial free, free to listen to, free to send. It's just an MP3 file, and we make that available along with Claire's bio and all the shows we've done with her prior, and some books that she has been part of. I didn't include that before. See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism. I like it. It's got the three monkeys. The FBI has its eyes covered, DHS has its ears covered, and the State Department has its mouth covered. She co-wrote that with Frank Gaffney. And then Secure Freedom Strategy, A Plan for Victory Over the Global Jihad Movement by the Tiger Team. And I just, I don't know, can't say this strongly enough. There's a lot of information out there about all this, but so much of it is either incomplete or wrong that it's really worth getting informed. And then when you hear stuff, it'll make more sense to you. So,
yeah. So we were talking about...
Back to where we were.
The possibilities of what could happen over there. Claire, you know, we look at several different scenarios that could happen, and fairly soon over there. What's your prediction? Revolution? Regime change? Military takeover? What do you think the possibilities are?
You know, I really don't know at this point. It looks like the regime has enough internal cohesion, ability to retain control over the people at this point. The fact that the United States and Israel just quit the field of battle in the middle of the operation left the Iranian people high and dry, abandoned again to the mercies of this brutal regime. I do think eventually, yes, this regime is going to go down. But how and when exactly that might happen, so hard to say. And I'm not even ready to make any kind of predictions at this point in time, but you were right to mention before, Bill, that there's a very harsh crackdown going on right now.
Yeah, a lot of times those crackdowns kind of backfire on regimes. Is there, you know, I kind of feel that Iran was on their knees. I mean, they were defenseless when Israel and the U.S. pulled out. I mean, they could have had their way with them, and they were having their way with them. What was the options for the U.S.? I mean, we didn't want to get involved in another war over there. Should they have just let Israel continue to pound on them until they collapsed?
Well, there were a whole bunch more targets left to hit. You know, nobody ever actually considered getting into a war. Striking a certain number of discrete targets in the nuclear weapons program and ballistic missile program is not the same thing as a war,
no,
which was never contemplated by Israel or the United States. During Israel's, Operation Rising Lion, they concentrated on the nuclear weapon sites, Natanz and Fardo and Isfahan. And as we said, some of the leadership of the guardians of the regime, if you will, and also the nuclear weapons scientists. But in taking out the ballistic missile sites, and especially the launchers, the missiles themselves, but the launchers more importantly, the Israelis understandably focused on those furthest to the west. Iran's a big country. But by focusing on the ballistic missile facilities, launchers, and so forth in the western part of the country, they destroyed the Iranian regime's ability to use Iran's ballistic missiles from there to reach Israel, which they had been doing. So that stopped that. They had no more ability to launch from the east. From the western part of the country, and actually be able to hit Israel. But to the eastern part of the country, whole bunch more sites, that were never, as far as I know, never touched. And could have been, I think probably would have been, should have been, had the operation been allowed to go on. But I think probably the U.S. kind of twisted Israel's arm and said, we want to stop this now and we want to go do some deals. And that's where we're at the moment with all of these targets left to be struck. We don't know, and indeed, the Director General Rafael Grossi of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, has said publicly he does not know where close to 900 pounds or over 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium is. I mean, I cannot imagine. I'd be very surprised if the Iranian regime had not already secreted away highly enriched uranium. I personally think they also have weapons-grade uranium and warheads. Secreted them away in some other place. Iran, as folks may know, is a very mountainous country with various different mountain ranges. And there were other places in the country, base mountains, inside of mountains, where things could be hidden. Now, I don't know. And I get the impression the U.S. intelligence community really doesn't know much either. But the Israelis will know. The Mossad will know because their network is still there, or at least, some of it is still there. That network will identify where the missing uranium went, if it went, and what other sites are doing what. Are they still able? Did they move centrifuges? Did they install centrifuges in other places? This location that some people are mentioning called Pickaxe Mountain. Did they put stuff in there? Again, I would be tremendously surprised if the Iranians had not thought about this well in advance and already prepared backup sites that were not in the news, were not in the IAEA reporting, were not necessarily even known to the Mossad or anybody else. I'd be surprised if they had not already moved centrifuges and enriched uranium at whatever levels, 20, 60, 90, warheads, which, they were already working on, we know that, to the new secret place or places.
But
I'd be very surprised.
But how do they, they say it's missing. Well, I'm sure there's a
lot. Because they don't know where it is.
Well, I'm sure they don't know where a lot of it is that's buried 1,000 feet underground in that rubble. How do they know it's not still down there?
Well, because previously they had a good view of what was inside there, the IAEA, inside of at least those places like Natanz, Fardo, and Isfahan, where enriched uranium, you know, was kept and was worked on.
And they had access to that?
They had access to a certain extent. They had cameras. They had monitoring devices that sniffed radioactive particles, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But they have lost track of that, partly because the Iranians destroyed the cameras, destroyed the monitoring equipment long before these attacks. So, you know, they don't know. We don't know where a whole bunch of enriched uranium is, was, or went to. Is it possible it was all destroyed under Fardo? Maybe, but I think highly unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean,
they're not gummies.
Is it likely that Mossad is sharing that with our folks, or would that be?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, they would share. They do share, as I understand it, everything they receive. I also know that the NCRI shares everything they get with both the U.S. and Israel and the IAEA. So there is sharing of this intelligence all the way around. And we don't, in the public, we don't have access to all of that. We know what has been reported openly in the IAEA reports. We know what the NCRI has, you know, publicly shared in the five open press conferences that it has held since last December, 2024. But we don't know what we don't know. And there is very likely a good deal of classified information to which we have no access.
So it's kind of like anybody's game right now?
Well, there's, like I said, a lot we do not know. And again, knowing the Iranians and how they operate, I would be very surprised if they had not already taken steps long before these two operations of the Israelis and of ours to go after the well-known. I mean, the names of Isfahan and Natanz and Fardo on everybody's lips. Everybody knew about them. Everybody was talking about them. Would you leave your most valuable stuff inside there, knowing how publicly these places were known? No, of course not. I think it's very likely that they moved stuff, or simply not even moved, but just installed from the get-go, centrifuges and equipment and, you know, metallurgical milling equipment to shape, to form the enriched uranium, the weapons-grade uranium, into the hemispheres that are put together to make a warhead, mm-hmm. that they had not already moved or installed and or installed all of that in other place or places, you know, way before the attacks. I mean, of course that's what they would have done.
Now, if they like right now, they have satellite images of excavators and dump trucks and so forth at yep. those sites cleaning up, and my guess is they're probably digging stuff out, trying to see what's left.
Yes.
Do you think they'll allow them to go back in there and rebuild all that, or do you think they'll be swift
no.
and just take it out again?
I think that both Israel and President Trump, you know, have said that if they make any moves to reestablish, to repair, reconstitute their nuclear weapons program, and President Trump has said this very explicitly, he will not hesitate to strike again.
Mm-hmm. Which you pretty much have to. I mean, you've gone down
yeah.
this road
yeah.
this far. You can't let them go back and start this process all over again. And I would imagine
no.
if they do figure out where this other stuff is, they'll probably go after that as well.
I would think so, yes. The question is how quickly... Well, do any other places exist, first of all? Because I'm not saying they do. I'm saying I would be surprised if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But... You know, first of all, do they exist? Where are they? What's being done in them? You know, how advanced are the nuclear weapons programs, you know, being carried out in those places? You know, an awful lot of intelligence remains to be discovered. But yes, once or if, when such places are discovered, then Israel will have no choice. It's existential for them, obviously. And President Trump himself has also been, you know, very definitive. He will not hesitate to strike again.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that allowed them to be this state sponsor of terror throughout the world was their ability to move resources to their allies.
Proxies.
How badly is their money flow situation been hit, or has it been, and are they still able to supply the Houthis and Hamas and these other organizations with money and resources to continue to fight?
I think that money flow has been very severely curtailed, if not shut off. The means to even have the funds to continue to supply Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, not functioning right now.
Mm-hmm. Have we cut off their ability to move oil?
Not completely, but that has to happen as well. Again, that's why you'll hear discussions about striking the oil facilities, but that's not happened yet. In part, I think not happened yet because we, the United States, maybe Israel too, others, don't want to deprive a successor regime, this I should say successor government in Iran, should that succeed in taking the place of the current regime.
That's true. We leave them with nothing to start with.
To be left without any means of support or, mm-hmm. Financing industry. But in the meantime, the sanctions that the United States and the United Nations imposed upon Iran, but were never effectively enforced under the Biden administration, and indeed actual waivers were granted instead, those sanctions have to be enforced. And I think that under President Trump, they are and will be. And that especially goes for China, which imports something like 25 or 30% of its energy needs, particularly in oil, from Iran. And that mostly travels by ship, sometimes what they call these ghost ships. There's a trans-shipment of the contents of one ship to another tanker on the high seas someplace, that's all got to shut down. But I mean, even in the meantime, are the Iranians able to maintain their own oil and natural gas industries? No, their key places like Harg Island or Bandar Abbas have not been struck. Probably will not be. There was talk briefly, ever so briefly, that the Iranians themselves, their majlis, the parliament, actually voted in favor of shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, this narrow passageway between Iran between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula, Bab el-Mandeb on the other side. But there was a vote in the Majlis to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and that talk kind of went away pretty quickly. That vote in the Majlis would have had to have been approved and supported by the Governor's Council or the Guardian's Council, and also then finally by the Supreme Leader himself, Ali Khamenei, and that just didn't happen, probably in large measure because the Chinese squawked. Maybe others did too. So that doesn't seem to be happening right now. But, what is the ability of the remainder of this Iranian regime, to maintain its energy production shipment? Not real clear right now, but certainly damaged, certainly degraded, or the transfer of funds, as you asked there, Bill. And even before this, the Iranian people, heading into the brutal summers, the heat over there is unbelievable. We think we're having it bad, which we are, but they're having it much worse. Electricity was in short supply for the population of Iran. They were also in short supply of water because of the total corruption and mismanagement of the regime and also the shipment of their oil supplies and, you know, gas, natural gas supplies, especially over to Iraq, out of the country, which did not benefit the people. And when the money came back, which, again, the Biden administration allowed them to be paid, that money, you know, just as you were hinting at their bill, went to their proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, the Hashdashabi Shiite militias in Iraq, and did not benefit the people. As we said before, there's about 90 million population in Iran, and something like 80% of them live below the poverty line. That's the Iranian poverty line, not the American poverty line, you know, with Cheetos and chips on the couch in front of a 52-square-inch, you know, flat screen. No, 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 no. The Iranian poverty line, 80% under it.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So
let's take a really quick break, and I kind of want to know more about that, how they're... I guess it's pretty easy to subjugate people if you keep them poor. And anyway, we'll get back into that with Claire when we get back. Her name is Claire Lopez. Today is June 29th, 2025. Archive will be up this afternoon. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. Wanted to give you a little weather report. I looked it up during the break. And in Tehran right now, it's 89 degrees with 14% humidity. And in Redding, California, where we are currently residing, it is 101 with 22% humidity. So we might...
Well, we've been up in the 90s here in Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C. for the last couple of weeks.
Yes. Having grown up back there, when you're talking 90 on the East Coast, you're looking at what, 80% humidity, 85?
Humidity.
Yeah,
lots of
humidity.
Yeah. It's awful.
I do remember just sweating, just, you know, you're sweating in the shower. You just get out and you can't even...
Practically. Not quite, but practically.
Don't bother using the towel. There's no point. Yeah. In a house with no air conditioning, you might as well just... Yeah.
Oh, that's what we grew up in.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, awesome. Yes. How well I remember. No air in school, no air in church, no air anywhere, which was actually probably good, because if we would have had to go in and out of the air conditioning, it would have probably seemed worse, and we were kids, so what do we know? But yeah, I'm well past that. But yes, it is 101 today here.
Wow.
So if you're hankering for the surface of the sun, just come on over and give us some time. I said it's 12 a.m. over there. Yeah, you know what? That's what I was... Thanks, David. I was looking at that. I'm like, I wonder what time it is over there. So, at night, 89. That's actually not weird for here either. Scary. Well, the good news is we're not wearing black tablecloths, so that's kind of a bonus. So with all of the stuff that we're seeing on all of this, do you think we're being kind of told the truth? I mean, what's with the leak and all that? We kind of skipped over that part. Think any of that was...
What's with the what again?
You know, the leak. You know, supposedly we didn't destroy their stuff. Do you think that was a...
That was just some preliminary report from DIA that was not final and was not reached with high confidence. I mean, forget all that. That was just noise.
Yeah, that was just noise, right?
Yeah, that was just noise. But the thing is that what's called the BDA, Battle Damage Assessments, that's still going on, and it will go on for a while yet, till we get real, you know, a final readout from, you know, IAEA, for example, or David Albright's group, which we call the Good ISIS. You've heard this before, right?
No.
Because David Albright, former IAEA inspector himself, formed this think tank group and named it the Institute for Science and International Security.
Oh.
And the acronym for that, unfortunately, is ISIS, right? So we always call it the Good ISIS.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll get the readouts from the IAEA, the Good ISIS, U.S. and Israel. But we shouldn't be expecting that immediately. It's going to take a while. And, you know, we shouldn't be jumping to conclusions or necessarily swallowing what might be rushed out to print in any of the media.
Yeah. Well, that's always the danger. And then, you know, they make hay with that. Oh, the president didn't do what he said. He, you know, he has to declare war. What about all that? What's your, I mean...
Well, he didn't need to declare war, number one, because we weren't going to war. And, you know, a number of targeted strikes against Iran's nuclear weapons, ballistic missile, hit the nuclear weapons facilities, that's not war. Besides which, you know, can you imagine what would have happened if President Trump had briefed members of Congress to include the Democrats? It would have been on the front pages of the New York Times before you could say go.
Yeah, before it happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and presidents don't typically do that anyway. I mean, you don't...
Well, there was no need to. And constitutionally, there was no need to. As commander-in-chief, you know, in the Constitution, Article 2 gives the president, he is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And there are so many prior examples of prior, earlier Democratic Party presidents who conducted all kinds of strikes against all kinds of places without going to Congress for permission first. But in this case, there was no requirement to do so in any case, but that it would have been foolish to allow this information in the hands of Democrats who would have, you know, run immediately to their favorite media outlets to leak it.
Yeah. Well, for all the people who think that this didn't have anything to do with us and we should have just sat back and left it all alone and stayed out of the whole thing, what's your take on that?
Well, when a regime takes power in a jihad revolution, immediately begins screaming from the heights of the new power, death to America and death to Israel, our number one top friend, partner, ally in the entire Middle East, and then immediately seizes hostages from our American embassy in Tehran and holds them for 444 days until President Reagan gets elected and is in front of the Capitol about to take the oath of office, and oops, the hostages are released. When that regime attacks our embassy in Beirut, our Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, by the way, under the Quds Force proxy, Imad Mughniya of Hezbollah, who later went on to play a role along with the Quds Force and Iran in 9/11, they hit our embassy, they hit our Marine Corps barracks, how many hundreds of casualties, and then I could list a whole bunch more. Eventually, they get to 9/11 itself, and the Iranians, this Iranian regime, orchestrated, directed, and executed the attacks of 9/11, where, by the way, now, a democratically elected a candidate for mayor of the city of New York, Zohran Mamdani, has been elected in the primary, the Democrat Party primary, for the candidate in the final mayoral elections to come, who is himself not just a communist and a Marxist, but a Twelver, an adherent of the 12th Imam, just like the regime in Tehran. And we know this because in a November 29 Twitter post, Mamdani wrote that he was a follower of the Ithnashada, that means the Twelvers. So all of that, put that all together, and I think that regime is gunning for us. They sent IRGC hit squads to the United States to try to kill former President Trump and during his 2024 presidential campaign, and targeted our former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and targeted our former CIA director and then also Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and others. Has threatened the United States repeatedly and explicitly, and was building missiles. They already have got, and we know because they fired them, short range, medium range, and long range ballistic missiles. We know they have all of those because they fired all of them at Israel and other places. But they were working on and close to being able to obtain and develop and field intercontinental ballistic missiles, which then could reach all the way to the United States. The missiles they have right now can reach to Israel, parts of Europe, and parts of Russia. But intercontinental ballistic missiles that they were well on their way to getting would then, in their intention, be able to reach all the way to the United States, and in their intention also would be tipped with nuclear warheads. So, yeah, they were kind of a threat to us, too.
It always kills me when these guys are like, we should just stay out of it. It had nothing to do with us. Like, really? Based on, what are you looking at again? I don't know. It's sad. They're probably the same people who think that they could go over there and, you know, roll a pride parade and just be fine. I guess it's
Here's another point that we could make right here, and that is that according to the Islamic Shiite Twelver eschatology, that is, followers of the 12th Imam, this regime and its top people, as I said before, across the clergy, across the judiciary, across the military, they believe not only that the 12th Imam is the Mahdi, the messianic figure of all of Islam, but they give him that specific identity of the 12th Imam, not only are just going to, like the Sunnis, wait for him to return whenever he, the Mahdi messianic figure, decides it's time to return, but under the Twelver eschatology, this regime and its leadership firmly believe they can hasten the return of the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, for them, to Earth, to usher in the end times, the Day of Judgment, and they do that by instigating Armageddon on Earth, and that's going to bring back the Mahdi maybe sooner than he otherwise might have decided to come back. And they are willing, they're absolutely willing to instigate Armageddon. And in the words, I'll quote Ayatollah Khomeini before he died. He said, "Let this land burn, I say, let this land go up in smoke, so long as Islam is triumphant in the rest of the world." This is how these people think. We can't let a regime like that, people like that, get the most, you know, dangerous weapons on the face of the earth, a nuclear weapons capability.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it. That's a huge consideration, and I don't think it's one we make enough. We always, I don't know. Seems like we always soft sell it. Let's take a really
quick... Because they don't know these things. Well, I will bet you dollars to donuts that nobody has ever briefed what I just told you to President Trump and his inner top circle. Dollars to donuts. They don't know this.
Oh, that's a good point. And the general public pretty much doesn't either.
Well, worse yet. I mean, Mike on the street, Mike on the campus, no way. They don't know.
Well, they're not. You know, the funny part is... There are a million examples we could point to, but the funny part is that my favorite one is that they were going to do their No Kings protest on July 4th.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, how ironic. We're already 14th, celebrating,
right?
That.
It was Flag Day. It was June 14th.
Right. But the second one they have targeted for July 4th, and it's like, really? No Kings on July 4th? Isn't that why we celebrate July 4th? Yeah,
kind of.
Really?
I'm sure they don't know that, or, you know, who King George was, or
right.
Probably never read the, you know, the Declaration of Independence, or why we declared independence from King
right.
George in Britain back way then.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, kind of sad. And I don't know. I don't know that it's any better around the world, but I got to tell you, it's getting kind of bad here. Let's take our last really quick break. We'll come right back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. And Claire, when we come back, if you don't mind, do the elevator version of what you just did, the part that the president needs to hear and that the public needs to hear, because I just don't think we can reiterate that enough. Let's hit that one more time when we come back.
Okay.
You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay. Claire, if you wouldn't mind, can you reiterate your elevator speech that you're wishing that the president heard and that the public was told?
Yeah, sure. Here's what I would really like President Trump and his top senior circle of advisors, what I would hope for them to understand about this regime in Tehran and why it is different from every other adversarial regime we face or have faced, including the Soviet Union, currently Russia, the Chinese Communist Party, Kim Jong-un in North Korea. The reason this regime in Tehran is different is because it's ideologically motivated. They are true, believing, faithful, obedient Muslims, and they are Shiites, followers of the 12th Imam. And what that means is that they believe, unlike the Sunnis, which are bad enough, but this regime in Tehran are what we call 12ers. And that's because they believe that the 12th Imam, that would be the 12th in a line of Imams, father, son, down from Muhammad, as they believe, who was a little boy in the 900s, ninth century, I should say, and fell down a well and died, leaving no heir. And the Shiites were hard put to decide, what can we do? What can we do? No heirs, no successor. And they decided he's not really dead. He's just down there in the well. But actually he's an occultation and he's all around us. They believe this, okay? I know this sounds wacko. They believe this. And that he, the 12th Imam, will be the Mahdi, the messianic figure of Islam, who returns at the end of times to usher in the Day of Judgment, kill the pig, break the cross. This is what they believe. Break the cross means kill any remaining Christians, kill the pig, the same for the Jews.
Oh.
They believe that the Mahdi will come back and do this by ushering in the end times and Day of Judgment, and that there Mahdi is the 12th Imam, and that they can not only just await his return to earth and follow his commandments obediently until then, but they believe that they can hasten his return to earth. They can make him come back sooner than he otherwise might have by instigating, literally, Armageddon on earth. And with enough chaos and strife and warfare, Armageddon on earth, the Mahdi, the 12th Imam for them, will be compelled to come back and set it all straight, and thereby usher in the 1,000 years of Islamic rule on Earth. And that eschatology, that belief, that ideology, you know, among a regime that is driving for a deliverable nuclear weapon carried on the tips of intercontinental ballistic missiles, is about the most threatening thing I can think of. And unless we understand that that's how they think, and that they are willing to die, fi sabilillah, in the way of Allah, God. Allah means God in Arabic. Fi sabilillah, to die in his way, they are not a death cult, except for us. For break the cross and kill the pig, they're a death cult. But for themselves, they're a cult of immortality. They believe that not only would they be contributing to the immortality of Islam on earth, they believe that they themselves individually will win eternity in paradise with God by doing all of these things and obeying the commandments of Islam and of the 12th Imam in Shiite Islam.
Yeah, how do you integrate that with any society?
Yeah, right.
You know, you don't.
That's not an optional belief system. It isn't like here where if you don't want to be, you know, Lutheran, don't go to the Lutheran church. I mean, it's not an optional belief system. You either believe it and participate in making that all happen, or you shut up. Are those the choices?
Yeah, I mean that's it. Although, as we talked about earlier in the show today, many Iranians, especially among the younger, large cohort of young people in Iran, they simply don't believe, they don't follow, they're not obedient to the commandments of Shiite Islam, much less to the eschatology of the 12th Imam. But you know, you don't go around trumpeting those beliefs out loud or too loudly. If you you want to, you know, spend any more time here on Earth.
How does it work over there? Are you conscripted into the military? Is it an age thing? Do you join? Is that back to the point of the sword again?
The Artesh, as we said before, the ones that I hope some units will defect, is the conscript army. Yes, they're conscripted.
Okay.
Drafted to that army. That's the regular army. But after Khomeini led the revolution back in 79 and overthrew the Shah, he knew that a conscript army might not necessarily always be 100% loyal to the regime that forces them into military service, which they don't want to do. So that's when he, Khomeini, established the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and as you can see from the name of the title of the group themselves, Revolutionary Guard Corps. They are the guardians of the revolution. And if you go to the Iranian Constitution, which is in English online, it's not hard to find, you will see that there is a section in the preamble of that Constitution which is headed by the words, the ideological or an ideological army. That's the IRGC. And it quotes directly from the Quran, from verse 860, specifically of the Quran, which says, strike terror into the hearts of the enemy. Gather your forces. Make ready your forces, including steeds of war, to the utmost of your ability to strike terror into the hearts of the enemy. That's the job of the IRGC, and it's the job of the IRGC to keep the regime in power, defend it, and to spread, this is also in the Constitution, the preamble, to spread that revolution, and that's the purpose of the proxy groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis and so forth, spread that revolution, the Islamic revolution. It's not Islamist. This isn't Islamism. This is Islamic Republic of Iran. Spread that elsewhere around the world.
There's just no room for dissent. There's no room for bargaining.
No, this is not government by consent of the governed or, you know, individual liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, those sorts of things, freedom of religion. No, that's not part of it. That's not part of Islam.
Mm-mm.
Those are anathema to Islam, which is why they want to destroy us of Western civilization and the free world, because we believe in those principles.
And how do they square that with the rest of Islam? I mean, you have these other groups that aren't as radical.
They're not radical. They're disobedient.
Oh, okay.
They are disobeying. They are disobeying the commandments of Islam. In other words, many Christians, for example, you know, they may not go to church when they're supposed to every Sunday. Jews eat pork. Mary outside of the faith, that sort of thing. Every faith has those who are nominally of that faith, mm-hmm. but really don't obey the commandments. And that's what you're talking about. You're talking about Muslims who may actually be very good people, and everyone should be, you know, dealt with on an individual basis, not lumped together until you know who they are. But if they are claiming to be Muslim, which, by the way, the Arabic word Muslim means one who submits to Sharia, one who submits to Islam. That's what the word actually means in Arabic, one who submits to Sharia. Now, if you don't, you can still call yourself whatever you want, I suppose, and maybe in some places that's the safer bet, but that doesn't mean that you're devout or faithful or obedient to Islam, to Sharia, much less to the eschatology of the 12th Imam. So there are loads of people who may very well be raised in a family that calls themselves Muslim, but they're not obedient, they're lax, they're disobedient, they're fallen away, they're cafeteria style, whatever you want to call them. But they're not radical. I mean, the ones who obey are not radical or extreme, they're mainstream. That's what mainstream Islam is.
It's just radical. It's radical to us.
No, not at all.
No, I mean it looks radical,
right?
To us, because we don't know the rules.
No, because we're Christian or Jewish or something else. But if we talked about Christians and said, if you go to church on Sunday when you're supposed to and keep the holy days, and if you try to obey the Ten Commandments, you're a Christianist radical extremist. Well, certain committees in Congress might say that.
I was going to say, we did have a little problem with that there for a while.
Most of us would not call that Christianist or extremist. We would call that, those are faithful, devout Christians who do that. And the same thing for the Jewish people, you know, who try to keep the commandments of their faith as best they can. They're not Jewists. They're not radical Jewists or extremist Jewists. They're devout and they're faithful. The same thing with Muslims. If they obey their commandments faithfully, they're mainstream. That's normative. That's orthodox. That's straight up the middle. That's not radical.
talk to us about we've got 4 minutes or 3 minutes or something. You know, the countries that are all around them, we see them all as a voting block, if you will. Are these guys the ringleader of the, you know, of the rules? I mean, are these the guys that are just the tightest on all the rules? I want to say the most radical. I'm without vocabulary since I can't say that anymore. What about the neighboring countries? Are they just sort of hanging back, letting these guys take the lead? Or are they just better at doing it?
The neighboring countries, let's say in the general Middle East, not talking about Muslim countries like, you know, Malaysia or Indonesia way out in East Asia. I'm talking about, you know, the heartland of the Middle East, maybe across North Africa, but in particular the Middle East, right? And in particular there, those countries of the GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council, and that would be Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, and so forth. These are Sunnis, majority Sunni. Now, the majority population of Bahrain is Shiite, but the regime is Sunni. But Sunni, they see the biggest threat to themselves as coming not just from the Muslim Brotherhood, that's internal, and they fight them hammer and tongs, but Iran, the Shiites, the crazy Persian Shiites, who want to seize back the two holy places that they would call them in Arabia, Mecca and Medina, take them away from the administration of Riyadh, their goal to conquer those, they see them as their biggest threat. And that's why you saw certainly at least the Emirates and Bahrain be among the first signatories to the Abraham Accords, and why it is widely expected now, or hoped anyway, that Saudi Arabia, which clearly supported and was behind the Abraham Accords in President Trump's first term, that Saudi Arabia may join the Abraham Accords in a formal way in upcoming months. And so these are countries that are also under current leadership, at least. I will say under current leadership, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Zayed in the Emirates. They are more practical and pragmatic about their countries and their country's futures than they are dogmatic. It doesn't mean that they have, you know, actually fallen away from Islam, no. But they're very willing to tinker at the edges of social mores, like men and women together in cafes or theaters or sports arenas, that sort of thing. Women driving, holding professional positions in the business world. All that's happening because these countries, know that their future lies in a technological advancement in the 21st century, and that's not going to happen, you know, if the cameras are all on Chop Chop Square every Friday afternoon after Juniper.
Yeah, that is a downside.
They need the assistance of foreign investment to move away from strictly extractive industry, meaning oil and gas, and into other technological areas, you know, computers and AI and agricultural technology, medical technology, all of that, which Israel can help them with.
If they can work with them. Claire, I hate to do this.
Yeah.
Told you this would happen. We're out of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Always out of time. We could talk to you for days. Next time, we'll schedule it for days. How's that? I know you're going to struggle against it, but, you know, it's just a thing. Our guest has been Claire Lopez. Thank you so much, Claire. We'll have the archive up right away. You're listening to
Thank
We the People.
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran. Some rocks, tell the Ayatollah, gonna put you in a box. Bomb Iran, bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran. The country's got a feeling, really hit the ceiling. Bomb Iran, bomb, 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 Iran. Old Uncle Sam's getting pretty hot. Time to turn Iran into a parking lot. Bomb Iran, bomb, bomb. Tears, call the bombardiers, call the financiers, better get your ass in gear, bomb Iran.